and welcome to the Android Central podcast. It is Thursday, November 21st, 2019. My name is Daniel Bader. I am some guy who works at some Android site that you may have heard of. And we have another guy who runs another Android site that you might have heard of on this week's show. But first, Andrew Martinick, you're somewhere on the Upper East Side of New York for some reason. Why? What's happening?
I took a vacation in London, and so rather than going all the way back to the West Coast, I'm continuing said vacation on Eastern time for a little bit. You know, time zones suck.
Time zones are hard. Yeah, I understand that. And soon we will see each other in the Hawaiian time zone.
Most screwed up time zone.
The Qualcomm. What was it? The Qualcomm Snapchat Tech Summit. I think somebody sent that email a few days ago.
Wow.
That chuckle is the man that I refer to, David Ruddick. He runs Android Police, our frenemy and general good resource for all Android things. How are you?
I'm doing well here. Just to do the words good.
Do the words good. Just like we always do. Little inside baseball, because I was listening to your podcast with Michael Fisher early this morning, just to try to. I mean, you guys are taking podcasting a lot more seriously than you were, which I think is a good thing. You're doing three shows a week. Why, and how? Because I don't know if I could do that.
You know, we really just trimmed down the concept a lot. Like we used to have these mega shows that would go on for like an hour and a half or 2 hours, and they were in the evenings, and it was just, I just stopped doing them because I didn't want to go on the show at like 5 in the evening on Thursdays. We decided we'll just record them like at noon, and like most of them, if we don't have a guest on, they're only like 30 minutes long. So it's working so far.
I like it. I think we've actually... We heard like the vast majority of the feedback that we heard from our listeners of the last year was that our podcasts were too long. So we've also tried to shorten them. I mean, I know I'm going to get an email from somebody who's like, no, I love listening to when I'm driving across America in my truck. You know, more is better. But generally, most people are like, yeah, I don't have an hour and a half to 2 hours every week to listen to your show and every other show on the planet. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's great. But we're having you on the show because you've had some experiences with your Pixel 4 recently, and that got me thinking. You know, it's been about a month since the phone was released, and it hasn't gone so well for Google. And is this the year that Google kind of just seeds the fact that they're never going to make a phone that everybody wants? Like, you've been sort of digging into this, David, trying to figure out, like, why is Google so bad at this?
Yeah, and I talked on our show yesterday with Ron Amadio about this a little more, and Ron's obviously of a similar opinion to me at this point. His review just came out.
His review was freaking... It was like savage. Like, the most savage review I've ever read of any phone. It was amazing.
When Ron really busts it out and hates something, like, you really know. I will never forget the time he reviewed the Galaxy Note 10.1, the original one, and his final review photo at the end of the post was a picture of it in the trash. He just really despised that thing. So we talked about the Pixel 4 for a fair bit yesterday and like what Google's strategy is. And I think one of the, you know, conclusions we came to is, like, we were talking about, I think, before the show started, was the only good phone it feels like Google can do is the Pixel 3a, which is the cheap one, like where the specs actually don't matter. Like the phone where you're like, well, it doesn't really matter what's in it. You know, it's got a great camera and it has like unmessed with software. And those are the two best things about the Pixel. But when it seems like Google increasingly tries to do a phone that's more than that and tries to sit on the same like plateau as the iPhone and the Samsung Galaxy series, you end up with a phone that just doesn't compare well. Like, even when you look at OnePlus these days, I think OnePlus is building better smartphones than Google. And I did not think I would probably ever say that.
I mean, Google still has a first mover advantage in that it always has newer software. This year, the delta between Google having newer software and and like a company like OnePlus having it was less. And in fact, obviously, the 7T release came out before the Pixel 4 with Android 10 on board. But it's an odd thing. And I don't want to retread too much because every Android podcast in the world has talked about this over the last month. But here we are. And the thing that nobody talked about right at the beginning was that the Google had the same endemic performance problems, or the Pixel 4 had the same endemic performance problems as previous Pixels. And now you, among other people, are experiencing the same things, right? Stuttering app or stuttering camera, slow app loading, general jankiness across the, you know, across the board.
That's very interesting to me because I've been all over my Pixel 3 XL for being so terrible in all of those respects, but my 4 XL has been pristine this entire time.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, is it a matter of just you are the unlucky recipient of a load file that's junked up, or is there something else going on? Is this a wider problem?
Yeah, I don't really know. I mean, the camera performance issues have really manifested in the last couple of weeks. I mean, having the phone for over a month now, I've taken a ton of photos on it, and I've really started to notice that, like, especially one of the features that, like, I think is one of the biggest selling points of the phone has been the super, the new super res zoom. And I use it pretty frequently, and I've just noticed how bad the jank zooming in has become. Like, it's pretty brutal at this point for me. It evens out, but when you start up the camera, like it's actively aggravating for me at this point. I feel like I'm Artem now with all these stupid phone problems. But I've also had issues with like Google Maps getting pushed out of memory, all of my like, you know, my podcasting apps and like Spotify and stuff not playing well, but Spotify doesn't play well on anything. So that might not be related. Battery life has been like tremendously hit or miss. Like some days it seems okay. Some days it's like genuinely not good. So we always see this with Google's phones when they launch, though. This has been like the entire history of the Pixel brand. There are software issues that, you know, day one really seem pretty bad. And eventually Google starts to like squash bugs. But it does seem like there's a subset of people out there who pretty much have terrible problems for the lifetime of the device. And I seem to have got them earlier than usual. Like last year at the Pixel 3, I didn't have too many terrible problems, I didn't feel like. But with this one, it's definitely been noticeably worse. I've had issues with the face unlock recently where it just sits there and basically spins like it's trying to recognize my face, but it never says face unrecognized. It just sits there and spins and nothing happens. And then I have to enter the PIN or turn the screen off and back on again. And then it works. Like it's stuff like that where I'm just getting, there are things where it's just not a polished experience. Like you can really tell when Google starts rushing things out the door, which is what Google does. Mm-hmm. And I think after 4 years of this, I'm getting a little tired of it.
Is it enough to move you away from, because I know like you spent some time with the iPhone, I think it was it last year as well as this year?
It was, yeah, a couple years ago and then again this year.
And this year. You know, we're in a privileged position, blah, blah, blah. We get to try new phones every few days or weeks whenever they come out. But I mean, I'm at the point now where I am happy to stick with one phone all year if I can help it, right? I don't do as many phone reviews anymore as I used to. I'm sure you know Andrew does because you're basically our main reviewer. But David, like you're probably in the same position as me. If you have the choice of sticking with one phone, you're going to do it. Is the Pixel still that phone for you, or have you decided that's it's too much trouble?
I'm sticking with it for now. I don't know if I'll be able to stick. I think every year I will still try out the new Pixel and use it for a good long while. But I have a feeling when whatever Samsung rolls out, you know, next year comes along, and I usually do our Samsung reviews, I will probably end up switching to that for a while. This last year, I did use the S10 Plus for quite a while. I did switch back to the Pixel. Yeah, it was, you know, the battery life was pretty good. And, you know, there were a lot of reasons to switch to it over the Pixel. But right now, like, I'm kind of like, you know, kind of like eyeing my OnePlus 7 Pro sitting on my desk where I'm just like, yeah, that was a lot better in certain respects, despite the camera being like not as good. I won't do it because I want to see how Google irons things out with updates, you know, because we get them every month. you know, I only just got the November update like 3 days ago. So I want to see what happens in the December update, the January update, and what they keep fixing. And I think it's just like, you know, for what we cover, like it's just better for me to use a Google phone, unfortunately. I feel fairly locked in for a few months after Google releases a phone.
It's, you know, it's almost Thanksgiving in the US. And even though I celebrated fake Thanksgiving over a month ago here in Canada, you know, I have the experience of I get together with my family, and they all have phone technical problems, or they have some issues that I need to resolve because I'm the phone expert. Do you guys have that with your families when you go home for Thanksgiving or Christmas or anything like that?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. So are your families like...
It's like, it's a mixed bag.
Is it all iPhone users though, or do you have some Android users in there?
Some Android users, mostly iPhones, because, you know, that's just the world we live in. The iPhone people are like, they clearly have problems and they just don't care. They have some sort of a little workaround, or they're just used to doing the dumb thing that, you know, like they have a lot of things set to default, and you know, they're just dealing with it. The Android people, 9 or 10 times out of 10, it's my phone is slow. Like, I'm trying to open apps on this Galaxy S8 and it's slow as molasses. What can I do? And it's like, shrug. You should factory reset that phone, because it's going to take so long to actually troubleshoot anything happening on any given phone that, like, factory reset is basically what you have to tell them to do.
David, what about you?
Yeah, my family, you know, it's split between Android and iOS, and I've generally made it clear to all of them that I don't want to solve any of their problems, which is great. I did used to be the person who had to fix all of it, but, you know, my dad stuck with an HTC One M8 for like 3.5 years, I think, and that phone was like basically unusable by the time he was done with it, so... Yeah, and I think my mom is still on an iPhone 7 Plus. Like, so people don't upgrade very often. I think two of my sisters, one's an Android, one's on a Galaxy phone, one's on an iPhone, my brother's on Android. I gave my little brother a Pixel 3a, so he's on that. But when people tell me their phone's slow, I'm like, well, you can factory reset it, and that's it. That's the only suggestion I ever offer. I'm like, well, that sucks that doesn't work. That's too bad. Yeah, you just offer like, well, a little bit of empathy, but I just am so over fixing people's technology.
Yeah, I think the biggest problem, I like air quotes problem, I see with people's Android phones is they've left everything as it was out of the box, and don't really realize that they can configure things or find other apps in the Play Store to achieve the things that they want. So they think it has to be, you know, you have to just use the things that come out of the box and that's it. And it feels restricting. And it's kind of more like a, you know, never wanted to or figured out to, you know, how to dive in and like make the phone their own. And a lot of the problems can be solved by just learning how the phone actually works.
Let's just take a moment and imagine the number of people out there suffering with the stock Samsung keyboard.
Oh, I do.
Exactly.
Like, every time I see somebody using a Samsung phone, I go in and check whether they're using the keyboard. And then I do my 30-second elevator pitch for Gboard, but nobody takes me up on it because they don't. It's never a situation where I can sit down and like teach them how to use it or give them best practices. So they're just like, no, I don't want to change. I'm used to this. And I've never been successful I was successful once, but it was not on the day of. I just kept pestering that family member, like, hey, have you changed your keyboard yet? And then finally they're like, yeah, I actually took some time on the weekend and changed it, and it was amazing. But that is something, I mean, the keyboard thing aside, like, why I bring this up is, you know, it's 2019, and you know, Android and iOS have been improving iteratively for the last 4 or 5 years after major feature and UI overhauls in the early teens, we'll call it. And yet I still think that the endemic problems with mobile OSs, they're not getting any better. In fact, I think they're more complicated to use today, and people are having...
Definitely.
They're still having a really hard time intuiting how to use features that are supposed to be intuitive. And that's a problem.
That's my point about this, like having, like seeing people that have a phone they've been using for a year or two, and it still has, you know, all these default features turned on and like tooltips popping up and stuff like that. And it's very much feels like Windows Vista, Windows 7 or something, you know, where there's just all of this just like cruft and just things at the edges. And all people want to do is just their basic things, but they're faced with this like mountain of all these different things they have to configure. And it's one of the reasons why we've talked so much about how wonderful OnePlus software is, because there's so much less of that overhead and all that stuff to wade through just to do the basics. Whereas if you see somebody using a Galaxy S8 today, if they're a normal non-nerd person, so they're not listening to this podcast, they have no idea how to wade through and turn off all of this crap. And it's just, it's almost as bad now on the S10 out of the box.
It's like the water bloop noise on Samsung phones. That's how you spot somebody who has never changed a single setting on their smartphone.
Yeah.
Bloop. Yeah. That's, I mean, it's funny that it's not there anymore, right? But it was there like 2 years ago or something. I think prior to One UI.
Yeah.
It was still the default sound. I mean, if you leave your sound on as opposed to turning it on to vibrate or silent, you're a monster anyway, and it's unforgivable. So, I mean, that's a whole separate conversation. But yeah, I agree. Like the thing I find really interesting is I've been thinking about the reception to Google's transition from navigation, its navigation journey up till now with gestures on Android 10. You know, the three button navigation layout at the bottom was basically the same. It's evolved a little bit, went from capacitive buttons below the screen to on screen buttons, you know, many years ago. And then it's been similar ever since. Other companies have tried to do gestures and have largely failed. And now we have a Google putting its foot down to some extent and forcing OEMs to include its version of gestures. We know now that like One UI 2.0, for instance, allows for both Samsung's and Google's, and it doesn't give you, it's not like Google's is recommended. It just gives you the choice. But I've gotten used to Google's gesture system, and I actually like it a lot now. And I'm thinking, how do people, like when Apple went from the home button to the iPhone 10 and introduced gestures, it did not seem like the cognitive dissonance was enough that people in the, you know, culture in general didn't get used to it pretty quickly, right? People were pretty okay with it. It seemed intuitive enough. Can we say the same thing about the Android 10 version?
I mean, I'll push back on you on the move to the iPhone 10 gestures a little bit, because while people understand the main paradigm of the home and back and multitasking on the iPhone, I couldn't tell you how many times I've had to explain to people how how to access Control Center, or how the lock screen works, or how to clear notifications on the iPhone. There's still a lot of very hard to figure out, like doesn't have a lot of affordance in the entirety of the gestures in the iPhone.
Yeah, I agree with Andrew on that. The Control Center situation is pretty unintuitive, but I think we have to give people a little credit in that, you know, we always like, I think as, you know, tech journalists, we can go too far one direction and say like, you know, oh, this feature is super useful. You know, you know, we're changing something, we're getting something new, but it's exciting. And then it turns out that like 98% of people will never use that thing. But I think we can go too far in the other direction sometimes and say, well, like, are normal people going to be able to understand that you have to swipe to do the home button thing? Like, I think we have to give people a little credit. Like, they can learn these basic things. I mean, if you were able to learn how to use a Windows laptop, I think you can understand how to swipe up on an iPhone. It's not that hard. But I think there is still some gray, you know, in terms of like what makes the experience good versus bad. I think Apple's is actually still significantly better than Google's new implementation. It feels more natural. It's smoother. It reacts in a way that feels more tactile that I think Apple's very good at. I think Google's feels pretty smooth, by far the best anybody on Android's ever done. Huawei's, I think, were like, a relatively distant second for me for a while. But I don't think changing this is going to really, radically change the way or confuse people. You know, when Samsung removed the home button, and I don't think anybody was terribly confused by that. So we'll see what they do on the S11. But I have a feeling that everybody's going to embrace the gestures. And that's mostly because Apple has them now. So people want a point of reference.
And Google has a similar situation going, where I agree, David. Like, they can't, like, the average person can figure out the basics. Like, the only thing you really have to explain to someone, or if you want them to not get frustrated, is trying to make sure you figure out the difference between a back-in swipe or an angled swipe to pull in the drawer on an app. That can be a little frustrating. And also dealing with apps that go into full screen mode sometimes. So like any kind of a gallery app or something like that that shows media full screen, you have to then swipe up and then swipe in from the edge to go back. You know, there's some more advanced things that are, you know, are kind of legacy crufty problems, really, that, you know, Android still has this whole back button thing going on. But for the most part, I think the Android 10 gestures are well implemented and the best that Google's done up to this point. And I was a real downer on Android 10 gestures when they first came out, but it, you know, after a few weeks of using them, you realize that, oh yeah, this makes sense. And it actually has a huge benefit of being able to go back from anywhere on either side of the phone.
The other question that I've been thinking about recently is, most people who are upgrading to a new phone, unless you're a teenager or an old timer, and you may have had a feature phone or no phone at all. Most people have existing smartphones, right? It may be a few years old. We know that some people are switching platforms, but generally people stay in their lanes. On Android, the loyalty is not quite as assured as it is on iOS, but one can assume if you're a Samsung user, you're probably going to be more likely to upgrade to Samsung phones, etc. The out-of-box experience, aside from the fact that carriers add so much bloatware, which does really negatively affect the first user, you know, the first load experience, is Android easy? Is it easy to understand? Is it easy to figure out? Is it intuitive yet?
I mean, I don't think you could paint with a broad brush there, just so we were talking about. I'd say that Oxygen OS on a OnePlus phone or Android 10 on a Pixel is pretty easy out of the box. Try opening up a new LG phone or a Samsung phone or a Huawei phone, and it's going to be overwhelming, even if you've used one of them before.
Yeah, I mean, I think that out of the box, Android phones are not appreciably harder to use than an iPhone. I think, you know, it's actually not really figuring out how to use the phone that really presents a barrier to most people. It's getting all their crap from the old thing to the new thing that I think, like, is still the barrier for most people and still what upsets them the most. Like, you know, when these transfer tools work well, they're okay. But a lot of times, like, I've seen, like, some people, you know, like, say with iPhones, well, I tried to do, like, you know, a restore from my old iPhone that was like different version of iOS and go to a new version of iOS, and like the restore just basically doesn't work, or, you know, it breaks a lot of things. I think those are the hard edges people come up against when they buy a new phone. I think learning things is, you know, phones are all designed around like all the same paradigms now. Nobody's doing anything radically different anymore. It's a grid of icons. You hit the thing you want. I mean, at the end of the day, that's what using a phone is, right?
It is, and it should be. I mean, that part about, you know, we were talking a couple weeks ago, Andrew, about how if you're used to using a fingerprint sensor to log into your banking app and all of a sudden you upgrade to the Pixel 4 and it just does not work, the average person is going to be like, what the hell happened? Or why is it so much harder now?
It's such a fundamental thing, right?
This repetitive motion, you know, this repetitive gesture that I was so used to. My banking app, you know, anecdotally, got updated to support fingerprint biometrics this week, but it's using the old API. It took them 4 years to add the old API, and there's probably going to be another 4 years to wait until they add the biometric prompt API. You know, this is a problem, and it's just like, it feels like we're always, you know, we're always like running uphill to try to get ahead of it, and it just seems like Android is not a priority for a lot of developers. I heard from people on dev teams at two banks, two major US banks, who explained, they didn't want to be named on the record, but they explained that their priorities are not Android, like, period. It just will never be Android. They have tiny dev teams for the importance of the apps that they have to maintain. And everything gets sent through these marketing teams that their priority is to sell product and not to make, you know, not to add security features. As you know, as much as it's important for the banks themselves to promote good password hygiene and two-factor authentication, technically those things are true, but that at the end of the day, they just want to make it easier for you to log into your banking app so that you can open another checking account or trade your, you know, stocks and ETFs and things like that. And that's largely why it's lagged. So many banks have lagged behind this. So yeah, I mean, I guess, like, David, just to sum up this topic, like, would you say the Pixel 4 launch has been successful overall?
Oh God, no. I think this phone is going to do terribly. I think Google is like high if they believe this phone will be more successful than the Pixel 3. I'm pretty sure it will probably actually, it could actually do worse. I think it will be either as successful as Pixel 3, which was a failure sales-wise, or will possibly even do worse.
Yeah, it's already such a bad situation if we're talking about the Pixel 4 being anywhere near the quote-unquote success level of the Pixel 3. It needed to blow the Pixel 3 out of the water 10 times over for anyone to even think about it being, you know, an actual success. And the fact that it's just kind of like neck and neck, they made lots of improvements, but our expectations were also higher because, you know, we had to deal with a year of the Pixel 3. It's like, it's kind of a sidestep overall, which is a shame because there are lots of things that are better. It's just Google also made many of the exact same mistakes as the previous 3 years.
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely true. But I wonder how important the addition of three new carriers will be, at least in the US, to those sales numbers.
I mean, it can't hurt. But again, we're talking about potentially a marginal improvement in sales there. I don't think that adding carriers, and I mean, sure, they had to do it. It's one of those things like, of course you sell your phone on all the carriers, and of course you sell it unlocked on Amazon from day one, like every other phone that matters. You should have done those things already. I wonder if just the addition of those things, if you say all else, everything else is equal, like that's not going to give you this bump in sales that they need compared to the Pixel 3's, purportedly real rough numbers.
Yeah, this is Google's playing like table stakes. It's just they're just barely doing enough to stay in the conversation. I mean, the only reason we really talk about them is because it's Google. If this phone were made by any other company, I don't think it would actually be that noteworthy at this point.
I think it's the Google name and the camera. And yeah, even if you had this camera but not the Google name behind it, it would be even tougher. But they do a lot of good things, but yeah, that Google name ends up getting them into the conversation in places where, you know, for as much crap as we give them, they would just be fully out of the conversation entirely if this was, you know, some other smaller company.
I want to talk a little bit about just your pick for best phone of the year, David. I don't think we'll have you on before the end of 2019 again. So what is your favorite device released this year?
I think it's got to be the OnePlus 7 Pro. We've been talking about this at AP a lot and keep going back and forth, you know, to like, you know, is it the only run like phones in contention are actually the 7T and the 7 Pro. We're just not sure which one, because the 7T is a better value. The 7 Pro doesn't have the notch, you know, and it's got a better quality display. So I think OnePlus proved this year that they could step up the game on software updates, which was huge. They took in 2 weeks to update the 7 Pro after Android 10 came out, like, because, yeah, of, you know, treble and mainline and everything. That was the point where I was like, all right, OnePlus may get, like, you know, may get flack for, like, its customer service, but, like, Google shouldn't get any breaks there either. So I think that it's hard for me to say that any company came close to offering the level of value and polish that OnePlus did this year. So I think we're going to end up having to give it to them.
Yeah, I'm leaning in that direction too, to be honest. I like the 7T better because it's just thinner and lighter, but
it's not a complete chunk.
yeah, the Pro is massive.
Andrew, we'll have a podcast rounding up our favorite devices of the year later on, so we don't have to spoil the
yeah
right now. But
spoilers.
We'll take a break and we'll come back and talk Google Stadia, because why not keep falling down this garbage rabbit hole? We'll be right back. This episode of the Android Central podcast is brought to you by Dollar Shave Club. So when I talk about Dollar Shave Club, I cannot stress enough the quality of their products. This company has spent years developing, crafting, refining everything. They have everything that I use to look, feel, and smell my best. You name it, they have it, and I use it. So I've been using Dollar Shave Club for quite a while now, and I never used to be a manual razor user. I used to shave my head and my face with the same electric razor, and it was easy, but I never really got a close shave, and it was convenient. Now I use manual razors from Dollar Shave Club. I use the executive razor, I use the shave butter, and the prep scrub prior to shaving, and then afterwards I use the delightful smelling dew. I just spritz it all over me, and it's really nice. And, you know, as amazing as that stuff is, Dollar Shave Club is way more than just razors. They can cover you from head to toe, including things you need for the shower, shave, hair, your teeth, and yes, even to wipe your butt. And Dollar Shave Club can keep you automatically stocked up on all the products that you use. You get what you want whenever you need it, whether that's once a month or a few times a year. So I don't have time to waste when I'm at a store wondering if what I'm getting is any good. And I know that as a Dollar Shave Club member, what I'm getting is of the highest quality. So right now, if you want to be a part of the Dollar Shave Club, you can do it really easily. Their Ultimate Shave Starter Set has basically everything you need for an amazing shave. It's got the executive razor, the shave butter, the prep scrub, and the post-shave dew, and you can try it for just $5. After that, the restock box ships regular size products at regular prices, but you can get your Ultimate Starter Set for just $5 at dollarshaveclub.com/ACP. That's dollarshaveclub.com/ACP. And we are very grateful, me and my face are very grateful to Dollar Shave Club for sponsoring the ACP. All right, David, let's talk a little bit about Stadia. This is, I haven't played it much. I just got my unit like today. But, you know, the reception has been tepid at best, and some people would say it's been excoriated, deservedly so. What's your kind of hot take on Stadia as a, not necessarily as a product, but just as a Well, let's start with that. As a consumer product, what do you think right now?
This is something that I've really wanted to be excited about since Google announced it, because I think it's the kind of thing that Google could potentially do very well. As launched and as the model of the business is concerned right now, I am starting to have very serious doubts that this is going to work. And I talked with Ron Amadio on our show a lot about Stadia yesterday, and I read a lot of reviews of Stadia to like get a sense of what people, I haven't tried it out yet. But one of the first things I saw was just the level of inconsistency in people's experiences. You know, some people were like, yeah, it worked really well. I did not really have any major issues. Some people were like, it was actual garbage on my Wi-Fi. I could only play with a wired connection, you know. And obviously, these are going to be issues depending on where you live, like the quality of your Wi-Fi router, you know, maybe if you have other things on your network. But those are all hard variables for, like, quote, regular people to control, and not the kind of stuff you want to muck around with. Like, I mean, I'm sure you guys remember the days of, like, you know, like playing gaming online, like setting up port forwarding on your routers and garbage like that.
Oh,
it was
yeah.
just nonsense. Like whoever
Xbox
wants
Xbox Live was just, that was frustrating.
Yeah, exactly. Nobody wants to go back to that. And so I think that was, you know, a major issue they're having, like perception wise launch day for the product. I think the other issue is I am really struggling to understand and define who their customer is. I don't know who wants this, who's
yeah.
going to pay for this. I think that's been the biggest one.
It's ostensibly pointed at a more casual gamer, but it's priced above, you know, what a casual gamer wants to spend on things.
Yeah, and I think that it's also the content, the product. Like, is a casual gamer going to want to play Red Dead Redemption 2?
No.
Probably not. That's quite an investment. Like, that's going to be a difficult game to learn for somebody who does not game frequently. I'm not saying it's like totally inaccessible, but when you look at a lot of the titles that they're launching with, it's like, well, these are fairly big, serious AAA video games that appeal to a gamer audience, an audience that is already committed to buying hardware, be it like a console or a gaming PC.
The kind of games that should be on Stadia, I mean, you could put the AAA titles in there too, but it should be more of the kind of stuff that would compete with like what a Fire TV with a Bluetooth controller plays. Like, cheap, basic, like side scrollers and casual games and things like that. Like, that has to be there too, which I guess just points to the general, like, if there are only 25 titles available, you're not going to be able to make a wide swath of anybody happy. But it's really odd that, I mean, I understand from a whiz-bang feature perspective, it makes it seem really great that, okay, you just have a controller and a Chromecast and you can play a AAA title. But not everybody wants that or is committed enough to that.
Yeah. I also think that the other thing I've seen that was kind of egregious, I'm sure you guys saw the post talking about how some of the games they're advertising as playing in quote 4K are absolutely not in 4K.
Not nowhere near it.
Okay. And that was to me like, that's just lying. Like, Google ended up just like, clearly whatever statements they made about these games playing in 4K were just actually wrong. And I think they should be taking the tasks for it. Like, Stephen Hall, 9to5, reported on it yesterday pretty well. He saw that, you know, some people been posting on Twitter that, like, Red Dead Redemption, in quote, 4K on the Chromecast Ultra, was actually rendering back at Stadia in 1440p and being upscaled. Which is just like, that's not 4K gaming. That's displaying a 4K image, but the game's not playing in 4K. And that is, like, that is actually deceptive as a practice. I think Google will rightly have their feet held to the fire by the fairly merciless gaming community over that kind of thing.
It is really interesting, though, because, you know, in the fine print, Google, they hedge a lot, and the fine print around 4K, HDR, 60 FPS, it's all very, you know, corporate-y, like, it's all, you know, gaming experience, including 4K, is service, network, device, and game dependent. It may not be available for all games in all areas. 4K capable TVs and high speed broadband are required to play in 4K. I mean, that is, it's hedgy, but it's still, you assume that the source is 4K. Like, you, even if you're reading the fine print, you're like, yeah, that to me, leads me to believe that I'm going to be able to play in 4K. I just have to meet all those technical requirements. It is egregious, and it's weird. It's weird that they, That wasn't hard to figure out. It took 2 days. So I just wonder, and the other part that we were talking about, I was talking about with my gaming team was like, there are no indie titles here. You know, there are no, Andrew mentioned this, like there are no casual games that are game or that are phone or laptop size screen optimized, you know? Like, this is a great experience to play on your phone if you want the claw, which I don't think anybody does. But like, if you want a casual gaming experience that's better than anything on the Play Store, this is a cool option. And yet there are no titles that really give you that experience the way that Apple Arcade has given you that experience. Is like, you have 100 games, you spend $5 a month, here are all these amazing titles that, yeah, they're optimized for mobile, but they're also interchangeable on your TV. Google has not done the other thing. They're all optimized for your TV. None of them are optimized for your phone.
Yeah, and I think this is symptomatic of a Google product that has to kind of play nice with multiple platforms. It's a problem they run into all the time. And it's, you know, I think a good analog is the situation with Android apps on Chrome OS, which is terrible, where like Google forced like a round peg into a square hole there. And what we ended up with is a situation where nobody's happy, you know, nothing works well. Google got to say on paper that this was a functional feature of their operating system. And I think that's what's going to, I think if they tried that with Stadia, if they tried to get those mobile games, those indie games that work well on phones onto the TV, we'd just find, wow, this isn't really optimized because none of this was developed with this concept in mind. So I think it was, you know, damned if they do, damned if they don't on that kind of integration. And I side with them, I think, on not really going down that road, because I think the result would have just been awful. But I still really struggle, I think, mostly with like the concept of who this is for, and the fact that I think that also another big one is this is still feels about 4 years early, I think. We're not ready for this. And I think that Stadia's big pitch, if it were 5 years from now, would be, guess what? You know, 5G is everywhere. It's very low latency. You can actually use this on your laptop, on your phone, on your tablet with a mobile data connection, and it will work right. I think the portability aspect is the biggest thing Google could possibly sell with Stadia. And right now, the portability is laughable. Like the whole pitch behind the service was game anywhere. But the reality is you probably should only game on a good Wi-Fi connection, generally only going to be at home. The controller needs to be wired into whatever you're using. Also, it doesn't work on all platforms yet. Also, some platforms don't get full resolution. And also, if you're playing on Wi-Fi, apparently we're still working out some kinks there. It's so unfinished. I think, you know, I know Google had to get this out for partnerships and everything. I think it's important to build the content library. So I'll be curious where Stadia is in a year. And I think that's, you know, frankly, where my level of interest is going to leave it. I'm going to watch it develop, you know, and see if Google really does put in the resources and grows the library and becomes serious about addressing performance, you know, increasing the visuals of the games, you know, beyond what they've launched with. I think it's what we're going to see with Stadia, the biggest, you know, thing that we're going to be able to draw from is what Google does in the next year with the platform, if it really is serious about it, or if a lot of the issues that currently we have are kind of intractable and Google does not have good solutions to them and doesn't make them a priority.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And I think what's a little frustrating is that I think the real interesting business here is Stadia Base. Right, it's the free to play option where you can bring your own controller and you can just sign up and you can play, you can buy games, and there's probably going to be lots of discounts, and you can just, you know, buy the games you want. I don't think that's the ideal business model. I think a subscription business model where you pay whatever, $12 a month or $10 a month, and you get all of these games included. That is ideally what I think Stadia should be in the long run. Buying these games, especially games that many people own on other platforms, is the wrong way to do it, at least at the beginning. But Google is a company that gives us products away for free. And this yeah. is asking you to spend $150 to get a Chromecast, right, which many people already have, plus a controller, which they don't need, plus subscribe to a pro model of Stadia that offers no value add at this point, right? I don't want Destiny 2 included. Like, I think it's the wrong approach to a good idea, and the business model just doesn't back it up.
Yeah, Google has all of these like things that it made decisions on, or you know, hasn't yet figured out how to do right to get through before we even face, like I think David touched on a little bit there, like the technical hurdles that they don't have a whole lot to do with in terms of people's internet being terrible, dealing with Wi-Fi, and like all of those things. You're still going to have to face all of those problems even after Google figures out the licensing and subscription problems.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, talking about how, like, you know, the state of like internet connectivity in America, like it's not consistent. It's not good in a lot of places. A lot of people don't have options. And, you know, ISPs are evil. It's just as evil as maybe more evil than mobile carriers. And so I think that the vision Google has compared to reality is like, it's so much messier. You know, Google basically decided like, well, you know, yeah, the service relies on up to a 35 megabit connection with very minimal jitter. And, you know, most people don't even know what network latency is. And it's just like, well, the reality is you have such a wide variety of conditions the service is going to encounter. And it will probably be, you know, 5 or 10 years in a lot of places where, you know, before eventually this is actually something you can, quote, use everywhere. That's a long time.
It is a long time. And I don't think anybody's arguing that this is the future, or arguing against the idea that this is the future of gaming, right? It has to be the future of gaming. I mean, yes, the next Xbox and the next PlayStation are going to be released as consoles, but every single company that has a stake in gaming future is doing streaming, and they have to find a way to do it in a way that's intuitive and a good business. So you can argue that Microsoft is doing it better right now, or, you know, Nvidia really with GeForce now has a really good, they've built a really good infrastructure, but Google is still the first one that has released as close to a fully formed standalone streaming product as we've seen. And it's getting there. So I think it will end up being less of a disaster than we think once we forget about these launch problems, but they really do have to figure out the business side of it. And just get better games on it.
Yeah, the selection thing will grow. I think we'll see that issue slowly resolve itself, because in the end, publishers want their games on platforms.
They do, yeah. And for better or worse, Google owns YouTube, and YouTube is going to be a player in streaming. And we know that Amazon, I think there was a report today that Amazon is prepping its own streaming service to run on Twitch, which makes a whole lot of sense. The one thing that this won't solve is VR, and we know that, like, right before we started recording, Valve released the trailer and details for Half-Life Alyx, which is going to be a VR-only Half-Life title, released next March, which is awesome and completely, it looks incredible, I have to say. But VR, you know, VR is something that will still need hardware. It'll always need hardware, and I don't know how realistic it is for these two paths to cross, but I don't know. I'm just excited about Half-Life Alyx. All right, let's talk a little bit about the last topic I want to talk about today is John. I always call him John Legere. I don't know why.
It's just Ledger, though. It's just your Canadian coming out.
It was just my Quebecois coming out. But John Legere is leaving T-Mobile around the time that Half-Life Alyx is coming out. I wonder if there's a coincidence there. And he is leaving it to Mike Sievert, who is the current president and COO of the of T-Mobile,
and decidedly not just a general jerk.
Is he a jerk? Is John Ledger a jerk, or is he just a showboat?
He's, well, both. Ledger, it's just very interesting that Mike has a dramatically different personality than John, because like T-Mobile has gone through its like complete transformation and change on the back of Ledger being standoffish and boisterous and totally out there and kind of not, you know, just like kicking to the, like, all of the norms of what like a uptight CEO of one of these big ISPs needs to be. And I'm not saying that Mike Sievert is going to be an uptight CEO type, but he's much more like calculated and capable of choosing his words and not kind of just acting like a fool sometimes.
Well, anyway, either way, rather, John will no longer be the spokesperson for T-Mobile. He'll still stay on as a director of the board. But this is happening as the company's on the verge of merging with Sprint. David, we've seen all of the machinations happening in public, the lobbying to the Justice Department, all the acquiescence to get this done, right? The selling off of Spectrum, selling off of Boost Mobile, the promise of providing MVNO support to Dish for 7 years while that company builds out its own network, which is completely laughable. All of this happened under John Ledger. His departure is important, but it's certainly not, I don't think it's something that we have to worry about, really. But for all intents and purposes, this merger is done. What are your thoughts on both of these happening at around the same time?
I think that John Ledger probably considered timing pretty carefully on this. I think he sees what's coming, which is honestly probably going to be a very difficult period for T-Mobile as a corporation. I think that, you know, for all the upside of merging with Sprint, you know, getting access to their mid-band 5G, getting their customers, having, you know, the basically the clout to take on AT&T and Verizon more effectively, I think that organizationally, it's probably going to be a nightmare for all parties involved. And I also think that the 5G aspect is, I think that T-Mobile and Sprint are both overplaying their hands a bit on it. I think that while Sprint's, you know, 2,500 megahertz, 100 megahertz block of 5G in the U.S. is obviously the most powerful piece of 5G real estate anybody in America currently holds, you know, it's still going to take a long time to build that out. It's still going to be expensive. And T-Mobile is, you know, behind Verizon, AT&T on their millimeter wave. It's unclear how invested in millimeter wave T-Mobile really even is. T-Mobile's larger 5G strategy of doing refarm and 600 megahertz is probably not going to have any considerable effect other than changing the status bar icon for your network on your phone. Like, realistically, it might increase speeds marginally, but it won't be a big experience difference. And I also think that the, you know, whoever is, you know, going to lead T-Mobile into the 5G generation is going to have the, frankly, monumental task of convincing customers that 5G is something they need to care about. And I don't think John Ledger wants to be that salesman because it's not an easy one to sell, I don't think. Yeah, I think it's going to be, it's probably the best time for him to get out of there. I think that if T-Mobile and Sprint do merge, I think they'll probably be pretty successful. I'm against the merger, but I do think it would make them more powerful. And I do think T-Mobile would have a lot more leverage. But I think it's going to be a slog.
Yeah, I agree that if he didn't leave now, he would have to stay put for the next 3, 4, or even 5 years if he really wanted to see this all the way through and not leave on a down note. Like Ledger, like coming up to the point where they're about to close this merger, like this is the peak of his arc with the company. He brought them out of like a really bad position and grew T-Mobile to an incredible spot where it's about to take over the last, competitor underneath it. And like, that's a fine place to leave. Like, he has nothing but good marks in terms of business performance underneath him.
I mean, there are, I don't know how many quarters of outperforming the two bigger carriers, right? T-Mobile, the only major difference here is that T-Mobile is a much more focused company. AT&T and Verizon have their hands in a lot of other jars. AT&T now owns Time Warner, which is massive and is on a quest to try to compete with Disney and Netflix by bundling HBO Max in, at every possible avenue. There's also, Verizon doesn't own any content of note, but they still own, what is it called now? Oath? Is it still called Oath? No, it's called Verizon Media Group. Either way, the media assets are significant on both sides, and T-Mobile just doesn't have that overhead. But the one thing T-Mobile has to get through before any of this happens is the plenitude of lawsuits that state attorneys general issued against the companies. Now, some have been dropped in the last few weeks. Many of them haven't, and states like New York and California are not going anywhere. They're going to continue this quest. Do you think, David, that the attorneys general, that these lawsuits will have an impact, or just they will just delay the inevitable?
You know, I am generally of the opinion that these are pork barrel suits. Like, the states want things out of T-Mobile and Verizon. I have a feeling, it's a negotiation. I think it's an ongoing negotiation, and I think it's gonna keep going on. Now, how long T-Mobile and Sprint are willing to live in limbo is always the risk. We've seen mergers fall apart all the time in the past because the red tape just gets to be too much, and everybody involved, gets way too frustrated with the process. So the states can't overplay their hand on this, and they could end up breaking it apart if they really are stubborn. We'll see if it does go to trial. I think we're still waiting to see which issues, litigation will really hang on. And we won't know that until, litigation starts to happen. I think it's likely that litigation is going to occur. I think, though, that's when the real negotiations are going to start. That's when it's going to be brass tacks. And we see what New York and California want from T-Mobile and Sprint. And I have a feeling it's probably going to be across the board. It's going to be labor. It's going to be commitments to service levels. It's going to be commitments to pricing, really, really hard, kind of hard stuff that's very boring, quite frankly. So I don't think that any of these states are against it on the more principled, place that some people are, that we see, a lot of people in the industry talk about it, where it's just like, we've seen what happened in Canada, obviously, Daniel, which you can talk about extensively, and that the consolidation of these carriers is almost never good for the consumer.
No, and only in the last year or two, when a genuinely well-funded and kind of self-reliant fourth player has entered the market nationally, have prices come down. But that took a long time. It took nearly 10 years for us to get to that point. So yeah, I mean, I find it interesting. 10 days before the Ledger announcement that he was stepping down as CEO, T-Mobile announced three supercharged uncarrier moves that will use transformational 5G for good. One of them was a 10-year commitment to offer free 5G access to every first responder at every public and nonprofit state and local. I mean, this is like such an FU to Verizon. It's not even, it's so transparent. It's just ridiculous.
Like, you don't actually care. You just care about stuffing it to Verizon. That's
100%.
Cool.
Yeah. I mean, it's good, and it's something that it should have probably happened already. First responders, especially those in high risk states, need to have reliable cell phone service. Like, it's just a thing that needs to be available.
So first responders don't want millimeter wave 5G is what you're saying.
No, they do not. Oh, man. Can you imagine just like battling fires in California?
Hopefully only, yeah. Things are only on fire down the main streets in the middle of the densest cities in the country.
Yeah, and if you go around the corner, you just lose signal. The other part of it was what's interesting is this T-Mobile Connect, which is a prepaid, it's a $15 a month prepaid option aimed at lower income consumers. Now, part of the concession with T-Mobile is that they have to continue, or with the merger, is that they have to continue offering the T-Mobile network to MVNOs at costs that are, you know, that are set today. So we're not, you know, T-Mobile's not allowed to raise prices for existing MVNOs, of which there are dozens, if not hundreds, across the country. And Sprint is also divesting a lot of its prepaid. I think Sprint has its own prepaid offering, but Boost Mobile is a much larger percentage of its prepaid customer base, as far as I know.
Boost and Virgin are the main ones, which they operate in wholly.
Yeah, exactly. So this $15 prepaid plan is really interesting because that is the kind of concession that I can imagine the AGs wanting from T-Mobile, right? The ability for them to say, okay, you know, your quest with this consolidation is to raise ARPU by getting more postpaid customers on board, by ramping up 5G so that you can continue to charge more, so your shareholders are happy, but we want you to invest in prepaid because lower income families and consumers in general need that. They don't care about 5G. They just want reliable service. $15 a month will get unlimited talk and text with 2 gigs of smartphone data.
But that's the silliest part about this thing is they recognize that the merger will increase prices for consumers. And so rather than not letting the merger happen, they're interested in letting it happen, but forcing them to offer a cheaper plan for a fixed amount of time, at the end of which the prices will go up. It just seems very short-sighted and very, you know, like they understand that the reduction of competition will raise prices. So why are you letting it go through?
Right, because, I mean, the whole part of this, the reason that this merger is being allowed is because of all these behavioral concessions, right? The T-Mobile is saying, we won't raise prices, we won't do XYZ, but you know, you just have to trust us here, right? The FCC is not forcing them to limit prices to a certain amount. They've never done that, and especially not under this current FCC. They would never.
And particularly T-Mobile in particular, in the last 3-4 years, has done a masterful job of raising average revenue per user without consumers really thinking about it too much. Like T-Mobile's revenue per user has shot up a massive amount and is now right neck and neck with Verizon and AT&T, but it still has the perception that it's less expensive, but it really is not.
Yeah, I think that T-Mobile, I've been saying this for years whenever they do one of the Un-carrier things. It's like, guys, every time they're revamping the plans, they're just inching up the cost of the plan that you probably actually want. Like T-Mobile is very good at playing this game of, oh, you know, like the entry level plan, $70. But actually the one you want because you tether your phone is $85 or $90 or more. And they've also managed to do the thing where like their group pricing is really good. If you have multiple lines, like T-Mobile's pricing is very aggressive, but single subscribers get like royally screwed at T-Mobile. I would never switch to them. It's just a bad value unless you have multiple lines. So John Legere did do a really good job with that. He started squeezing single subscribers more and nobody really noticed because I was actually pretty, I mean, he was bad. He's, you know, obviously a smart guy. I will never say anything, but John Legere like did an amazing job turning around the company, both like from an image and a financial standpoint. But what he did, he squeezed the people who frankly are the ones that are, I think, much less likely to raise a stink. which are the single subscribers, the people who are already paying a lot, who probably aren't looking too closely at their phone bill and don't really care very much. Whereas the people who are like, you know, really doing value strategy, the people who are on group lines with like non-family members just to save money, like he always appealed to them. So he managed to maintain the kind of image that T-Mobile is a value carrier while providing like a tier one experience. But at the same time, you know, everybody ended up getting charged more who was on like a single plan, or if you started to migrate off all of their older plans, obviously, which used to be admittedly a hell of a lot cheaper.
So my thing with the T-Mobile Connect, and it's the last point I want to make here, is that $15 to $25 a month is about what most T-Mobile MVNOs charge for that same amount of data. And I found that really interesting. I mean, we're not talking about Google Fi, because Google Fi's whole pricing model is ridiculous. But like we're talking about the, you know, the US mobile, Mint Mobile, whatever's, the ones that really just they're bottom of the barrel, as cheap as humanly possible, they'll give you 4G data, right? This is basically T-Mobile offering a competing product. And I find that fascinating because they are undermining the very tenet of their concessions is that they will not raise prices for any of these MVNOs. And that's going to happen for 7 years or however long they've agreed that they won't raise prices. And then after that time, Dish is ostensibly going to be ready to compete as a fourth carrier. Which is never going to happen. Never. They're going to sell that spectrum long before. All right, they're not allowed to sell it, but they have to have a certain number of facilities, you know, built out by that time. I don't have the details in front of me, but all that being said, I just find this to be a really subtle way of undermining a lot of what T-Mobile is promising with this merger. And undermining the whole idea that the U.S. has a vibrant MVNO market that can compete because the big guys don't want to have to compete in the low end, right?
Yeah, they don't want to slum it down there.
And here's T-Mobile basically offering this as a concession to all these attorneys general, being like, okay, here's what we're going to do for all the low income consumers out there who are demanding lower priced prepaid plans.
And then for the next 7 years, it will subsequently destroy every MVNO because it undercuts them.
Yeah. And who's going to go to bat? Who's going to go to bat for the MVNOs? Nobody. Like nobody's going to bemoan the loss of MVNOs, because honestly, most of them are like paper thin companies that exist solely, you know, at the luxury of all these carriers offering wholesale data. They don't really do much of anything. They're just reselling a service.
Did you see that Boost Mobile's founder, Peter Adderton, is offering to buy Boost Mobile back for $2 billion?
Really? Wow.
Yeah, he wants to buy it back in lieu of it being sold to Dish, and he wants to pay $2 billion for it. He sold this company back in 2004, and it raised $400 million back in 2003 or whatever, which is a massive amount of money for a startup.
Incredible.
Back then. And it's just like, this is so interesting that the tides have turned so much in the U.S., you know, mobile industry, that this guy can be like, yeah, I can take back this company and actually have a chance at competing again, because, you know, there's just nobody underneath. When T-Mobile and Sprint merge, there's going to be such a gulf in the number four spot that he thinks that Boost can actually be that number four. It's wild.
Yeah. Yeah, that is pretty crazy. And Boost has long been, honestly, like such a skeezy operation. Like, yeah. They're just like, it's really like they're totally shameless. Like, it's basically, Sprint has already gained a reputation in the US carrier market for like really like deplorable business practices toward, you know, consumers. Boost is still somehow worse.
Yeah, it is. It's I mean, they,
Boost
they,
is the prepaid phone you get at the end cap at 7-Eleven.
Yes,
it's true. Actually, that's exactly like,
you
what
don't,
it is.
You like your standards for that carrier are not very high. It's just always been interesting that it's wholly owned and operated by Sprint, and nobody really puts those two together.
Okay, so I want to end the show, David. I know that you recently bought a. This is like completely changing the subject, but I want to get it in before we end. The Surface Laptop 3. I've been seeing your tweets about it. I just want to know, should I buy one? Is it good? How's it holding up?
If you care about battery life a lot, no, you shouldn't buy it. But that's been true of every Surface that Microsoft has released, and that's just like living in Windows land. But I think if you don't care as much and you mostly want to use it as a home workstation with more occasional mobile usage, like, it's awesome. I love it. I think there's some small issues I have with it, but quite honestly, having heard like horror stories about Surface being buggy and like unreliable over the years, it's nowhere near as bad as anybody would have led me to fear. And Windows 10 is, I think, finally at a place where as a laptop OS, it's pretty good. Like, I've had to change some settings and tweak some things, but like that's living in Windows land. I think it's got like a beautiful screen that doesn't get bright enough. The speakers are amazing. The keyboard is really, really good. Not quite Pixelbook good, but getting there. And I love the 3:2 screen layout. I just think it looks so much better than all the 16:9 Windows laptops out there. So I don't know. I think a lot of people are also really loving the new XPS 13 convertible. I've seen that getting some rave reviews. But honestly, every Dell keyboard I've used is actual trash. I've heard that the one on that one is better, but I don't know. So far, I'm really loving it, though. Like, it's definitely become my go-to.
Were you a MacBook user before?
I haven't used a Mac since, probably 2010. It's been a long time.
Okay. So you were coming from a Pixelbook.
What I really wanted out of this, I wanted, like, with Intel, like, doing the biggest talk on laptop chips it's done in, like, 4 years, I really had to have a laptop that had the latest Intel chip in it. And so far, the Ice Lake chip is, like, it's really impressing me in a lot of ways. Like, the GPU performance is good enough that you could actually play some games on your laptop. Like, it's like, surprisingly decent. And, you know, Intel's, like, you know, just straight up single-thread performance has been great. Battery life is, like, I think I can get 6 hours out of it, continuous use, which is not fantastic. But that's kind of how it is with all the Surface devices and living in Windows land. But yeah, I've been really happy with it. The last Windows laptop I bought was the original new design XPS 13 with the chin shot webcam. And
right.
I came to hate that laptop with a fiery passion.
Yep. I gave it away. I couldn't use it anymore.
Yep. It's not good.
All right. Excellent. Well, thank you so much for being on today. I tried to keep this under an hour, but then I started ranting about carriers and prepaid plans, and we went over.
It was worth it.
Yeah, I think
David,
so.
Where can people find you if they want to learn more about you and your 7 podcasts a day or whatever you're doing these days?
Yes, I am on Twitter at RDRV3. You can see all the bad tweets I post every single day. It's a constant stream.
Can confirm.
Yeah, and I talk about cars way too much and just generally go off on everything. I'm also occasionally featured on a little website called androidpolice.com. You can find my when really a tweet doesn't encapsulate my thoughts, you can generally find them there.
And I highly recommend that follow. I mean, I doubt there's a huge subsection of people listening to this podcast that follow me and Andrew and don't follow you. I'd imagine it's more the other way around. But if you don't already follow David, I highly recommend it. Andrew, why don't you plug yourself?
Many of the same topics and rants as David, but just not quite as fiery, to be honest. I hold back a little bit, if you can imagine that, compared to David. You can find me at Andrew Martinik, MARTONIK, on the Twitter. And that's, you know, we retweet just as many Bring a Trailer links, but my takes are just different.
Yeah, I don't understand a lot of your car tweets, to be honest, but I did enjoy your savaging of the new what's it, the Ford
Mustang
Mach-E. Yeah. Yeah, if you think that looks funny. Bad, you haven't seen a Tesla Model Y.
Yeah, that's an unfortunate car too.
Okay, not gonna do it. Not gonna do it.
Come
all right,
on.
Thank you. My name is Daniel. You can find me at Journey Dan on all the things. You can find us all at AndroidCentral.com. And your homework for today is what laptop do you use and why? I'm really interested. That's not a topic we really talk about on the ACP. So are you a Windows? Are you a Mac? Are you a Chromebook user? Tell us what you're using and give us some horror stories about company-issued laptops and why you're forced to use that really, really old ThinkPad that you hate. Or not. Why you love the nipple. Do you love the nipple?
I don't know. Wow.
I went there. All right, that's it. Thanks for listening. We will be back next week. And until then, have a great one. Bye.
Bye-bye.